Episode number 218 with Doug Lightford. Welcome to the Heads Up Poker Podcast. This is Steve Barton, and thank you for tuning in. We have returning guest Doug Lightford. Doug was last on episode 190, 139, episode 34, and I think I'm missing one in there somewhere. Got a lot of interesting topics here. One I'm really interested in is habit forming and breaking bad habits. That's one I could definitely use. And Doug has a free gift at the end of the show for Heads Up Poker Podcast listeners. So, Doug, thank you for coming on the show.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here and chat with you again.
Yes, yes. You told me you're having a lot of construction going on at your house, but no jackhammers at the moment.
Yeah, so we're wrapped up for now. So, we have a pretty old building, and we don't want to spend money on frozen pipes like we did last winter.
Oh, God. Did they burst?
We did have one burst, yes, and it was not fun.
My folks have to deal with a little bit of that when they winterize their home, and my dad gets out the air compressor and blows out all the water in the lines. And I remember as a kid living up in Idaho, I remember one winter he was in a state of controlled panic, and he was underneath the house with a torch, trying to heat up the pipes while my mom had the faucets on and let them know if the water's running or not.
That is pretty much exactly what we went through last winter. I was down in the basement with a heat gun, for hours one night trying to get the things going. And we hopefully, with what we've done now, hopefully we won't have to worry about that anymore.
That'd be nice.
Yeah.
So you have your apartment upstairs and then you've got a commercial property downstairs?
Yeah, so we've been here for a couple of years. We bought this two-unit a few years ago, and initially we were renting the store out, but the resident moved out because of some issues with legality around what he was selling and, politics.
Was it a pot shop?
Yeah, it was.
Yep. Oh, it was. Oh, okay. Yeah. Shot in the dark, but I guessed it.
Yep, good guess. So it kind of sucked to lose that income, but it also kind of worked out with the timing of these repairs we had to do, not having someone in here.
Okay.
So we're working on that, and then we'll be putting it back on the market, hopefully in spring.
Right on. Good deal. That's that'll be nice to get that income coming in. I had to do something like that recently. I had a tenant in one of my condos in Vegas, and she literally paid off the property for me, now I got it free and clear. And, but after her living there for 15 years, I had to go in and do a lot of remodel work, carpet and flooring and paint. And just, there was some old light fixtures in there that looked like they'd been there since 1973 and just go through the whole thing. But, it was kind of a hit, but luckily I had to dip into my poker bankroll a little bit to pay for it, but it worked out.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious, Steve, when you have to do that kind of work on your property, do you get hands-on with that kind of stuff, or do you have someone, you just hire people to do it, or how do you usually go about that?
In Vegas, I've got a property manager, and he deals with it. So it's significantly more expensive than if I were to go out there and just do it myself. Mm-hmm. But the... the convenience of it, I guess, is I don't have to pack up all my crap in a truck and drive it all the way out to Vegas and do things like baseboard and stuff, and is worth it to me. Sure. When I had a property here, in Oxnard, and I live in Ventura, which is only about 20 minutes away, then I would just go out there and do it. Whenever something broke, then I would just go, and I didn't have a property manager. They just mailed me the check. So I saved quite a bit of money doing that. But it being so far, I mean, it's 300 miles from my house to Vegas. So I just go with the convenience of a property manager.
Cool. Yeah. That's stuff I've been actually kind of learning a lot about lately. I'm hopefully looking at getting another property next year. So,
oh, good for you.
I've been looking into, kind of how to analyze deals and whether whether a property manager would make more sense or being more hands-on with stuff. It's a trade-off, right? I mean, you got to trade your time for profit margin. So
yeah, that's the thing. A property manager, I mean, it's like anything else. You get what you pay for. You know what I mean? And I found that the best property managers usually charge between 9 and 10%. If a guy's only charging you 7 or 8, well, you probably get what you pay for. And it may take longer to find a tenant. He's not as motivated to get someone in there because he's not making as much. You get what you pay for. The convenience factor is nice. But the place in Oxnard, I was just so close. I knew that house like the back of my hand because I'd lived in it for over a decade and had done, you know, everything myself. So I knew where all the wiring and plumbing and all that stuff was. So it was, it wasn't much for me to go there and, you know, do something once every 6 months, you know, but, at a place where I'm a distance away, then a property manager would definitely be, at least my way to go.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm kind of curious if you experienced this phenomenon that we've experienced with this place where nothing goes wrong until you go on vacation or you're away for some reason. That's been the case for us since we bought this place. And we've had
that's what we call Murphy.
Yeah, exactly. Murphy
shows up.
Yeah, I actually have a quick story that I can tell you about. So this was probably, actually, I guess it's kind of a two-piece story where the timing where we bought this place worked out where, like, very shortly after we bought it, we were away for a week in Florida. Mm-hmm. And when we bought it, we actually had a tenant already in it in the store that was, they were doing a little massage therapy place.
Okay.
And when we talked to them before we bought it, they were kind of indicating like that, yeah, we like it here, we're planning on staying for a while. And then like a couple of weeks after we moved in, we were away in Florida, we got a text from them basically just saying, hey, I'm moving out.
Oh.
And that was the first one. And then we got our second tenant in, and we were away in Canada on a vacation, and they called us a bunch of times, but we didn't have service. So eventually, you know, at night we got back to our Airbnb we were at, and I had a frantic voicemail from this guy that he was trying to get money to CMP, the power company, and that they had emailed him saying that if he didn't wire over some money like right away, they're going to shut off the power. And it was a scammer. It was just someone trying to get him to Western Union money, and this guy just didn't, you know, he wasn't savvy enough, I guess, to realize that it was just a fake bullshit thing. And so he was freaking out. And so we had to call him and just say, don't worry about it. Like we auto pay you, you have nothing to worry about. But it just seems like every time we go away, something happens.
That's where a property manager is nice.
Yeah.
I will say with tenants, and I'm sure you learned it having this one though, like the thing that keeps them in is when something breaks, when, you know, if the stove goes out, you get a repairman out there that day, you know, so yeah. You may have to pay a little bit more, but they really appreciate it. And I've been a tenant, and I appreciate it when an owner gets like right back to you, and you don't appreciate it when they don't, and it makes you think about moving, you know, so it's, that's probably the number one tip I could give as a landlord is when something breaks, like you're on it, you know, where are you looking? Are you looking at another apartment? Are you looking at a commercial one? What are you thinking?
So I've been kind of looking at a couple different potential strategies, and I'm leaning towards multi-unit residential.
Okay.
And you know, I'd like to get like a 3 or 4 unit, just because the properties I've looked at around our area, it's hard to find a single family that makes sense as an investment.
Okay.
The multi-units seem like they're really good opportunities.
Yeah.
The only challenge with that is, you know, the 25% down, if you're not going to move in, or, you know, 3 to 5, if you are. So for me to be able to get into something next year, I would have to get that 5%, 3 to 5% down, or else I'd have to wait a little while longer. So trying to figure something out to make that work, but leaning towards multi-unit.
Yeah. Now, one thing you can do, and this is a trick I learned from my real estate mentor, is when you buy it, they're all your primary residence.
Yeah, okay? I've heard that too.
Yeah. So all this is it's you're not doing anything, like, I'm doing air quotes right now, illegal. This is just an agreement between you and the loan company and the bank. And the bank looks at it as, this is significantly less risk for them if you're living in it. You know, mm-hmm. you're more likely to give this place up as if it's a rental, which means they'll be stuck with a place and no guy paying the mortgage. So if you tell them that you're going to move into one of these units and you're going to rent the other three, you'll get a significantly better interest rate than you will if you say, I'm going to rent all four units and I'm going to live over here. You know what I'm saying? So you can do that. And you may even have to move in, like, air quotes again, and have some mail delivered there or something, but it will save you so much money on the back end, you know, in the long run, for the life of the loan.
Yeah, you're the second person that has told me that in 2 days, and the first person was a real estate agent. So I think I think that's the sort of approach I'm kind of
leading. Sound advice, yes. Another one too, and I've only learned this recently, and so I've started doing it with my loans from now on, is a 15-year loan. Mm-hmm. When you do the math on a 15-year as opposed to a 30-year, if you take out you know, a half a mil or whatever for your loan amount, you're going to save well over $100,000 by doing it on a 15-year note instead of a 30. And a lot of people tell me, they're like, well, I'll just do a 30 and then I'll pay it down in 15. I'm like, okay, then you have better discipline than everyone else, because something will happen and you'll just be like, well, I really only have to pay $2,000 a month instead of paying 28. So I'll just pay $2,000 this month, and years go by and they're on a 30-year note. But when you have to make that mortgage, you just somehow make it happen. You know?
Yeah. And also with the 15, you're going to get a little bit of a break on interest rate too, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's going to look kind of tough because, you know, your payment's going to be, instead of being $2,000 a month, it's going to be 28 or 31 or whatever. But in the long run, man, you will save yourself so much money. And then you're done paying it in 15 years and you own it and everything is just gravy.
Yeah, I've heard, you know, merits to both strategies as far as getting a 30 to getting a 30 year just to free up more capital if you're thinking about trying to get another property in the next few years or something. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think with any type of investing, there's sort of two pieces to it. There's the number side and then there's the emotional side. And I think that's true with real estate, just as it is with stock investing. You know, there's different strategies that just make it easier for you to kind of hack your emotional side so you don't screw things up. And I think the 15 year is a good example of that, where it forces you to make those payments.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it does. And then you're done faster, you know, it, then you snowball it into the next one. But good for you, man. That's cool. That's exciting. That's exciting. Yeah. So you had some, interesting points that I'm excited to hear about, and I know our listeners are as well. One of the teasers here, improving at poker without technical study, and you put basically working on yourself. What can you expand on that? What do you mean?
Yeah, sure. So I guess to kind of preface this a little bit, I sent Steve over just a list of a couple of things that I thought would be kind of cool to talk about on the podcast, and I just want to say first that this stuff isn't anything I'm an expert in or anything like that. It's just stuff I've been thinking about. It's been on my mind lately, so I thought it'd be cool to chat about. So the first one was, improving at poker without technical study, and then also habit forming and breaking bad habits. I think those two kind of go together.
Yeah.
And the reason I brought those up is because over the last couple of months, I've been having some pretty good results and been really consistent with my tournament results. And I think that a lot of the reason for it is because of, you know, not necessarily just studying the game and getting better that way, but it's just things outside of poker that I've been doing that are kind of more healthy and better habits. And I think that those are actually the biggest, for a lot of people, the areas where you can get the biggest gains in your poker results is not necessarily by getting better at poker. You know, there's certain things that I think are actually a lot more important than being really good at bluff catching rivers or knowing when to call a check raise on the turn or whatever. You know, if you're running 10 PO sims every day, but you're getting 4 hours of sleep every night, you're going to probably not perform very well at the tables.
Good point.
And, you know, that extends to diet, that extends to just being in a good mindset when you do sit down to play a session. So that's kind of just something that's really been on my mind lately.
What are some of the things specifically that you've changed in your life, so, I guess, to improve?
So I guess there's two that kind of stand out to me. One is kind of having a consistent routine that I try to do every time before I play. And I'm not at 100%, but it's probably like 80 to 90%. I do this before I play.
Okay.
And that is listing out my goals for the session, which could be as simple as like, I'm not going to register any turbos today, or I'm not going to play any cash tables. Today's just tournaments, you know, something like that. Or it could be like a specific area of the game that I want to kind of increase my focus on a little bit.
Like three betting or something.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. That's actually what I've been focusing on this week. So yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. And that doesn't mean you're going to like just hyper focus on three betting, but it's just, you know, a 5%, 10% increase, you know, maybe you'll pay a little bit more attention to that than you normally would. It's that listening to an Elliott Rowe MP3.
There we go. I love it.
Yep. Yep. And then just looking at like two hands before you play, just, you know, get your mindset. Don't go into the session cold. You can take 10 minutes and just look over a couple of hands. That's all I think you really need to do. And then the last thing for me is just making sure there's nothing on my plate. So like little to-do list items that I have on my mind, I just get them done before I play. And that could just be like taking out the trash or like reopening your mail or something like that. Just making sure there's nothing else on your mind before you play, I think is pretty important.
That is so key. I'm able to do it with the Elliott Rowe tapes, but you know, if there's something going on in your life at work or whatever, after you listen to one of them, you're just focused on the game.
Yep, absolutely. And the other one, which is a constant struggle for me and something I'm still trying to get better at, is just not playing the session if I'm not in a position where I should play, especially with tournaments. Like for me, I have a full-time job. Anyone that's listening that, you know, plays poker on the side, whether you're just doing it, if you're serious about poker and you're trying to make a little extra money from it on the side, it's really hard with tournaments if you have a full-time job. You know, a tournament session is anywhere from 4 to 10 plus hours. So if you're working Monday through Friday, it's really hard to get sessions in and also, you know, get plenty of sleep and take care of yourself. So what I've been trying to do is, if I'm on the fence, like if it's a situation where like, you know, I'm working at home tomorrow, I could sleep in a little bit, I could get like 5 or 6 hours of sleep and still play a session. I'm trying to just not play if I'm at all on the fence about it, which can be a real big challenge for me. You know, I really like playing, and like a lot of times I really feel like playing. But I know if I do, I'm going to be tired the next day. So I've been trying to just in those situations, like maybe just study a little bit and kind of relax, and then I'll play the next night or something.
Yeah.
I think it's important. And you know, a lot of times I believe that if I did play, I would be playing plus EV, and I would probably, you know, be playing a session where I'm probably going to make money on average. But still just trying to take that long-term view of sustainability, with how I'm planning out my sessions.
Good for you. I remember it might not have been the last time we had you on, but the time before, you sounded like you were just burning the candle at both ends. You know what I mean? And working a lot and then putting in like 30 hours a week in cards too. And I remember thinking, I don't think you talked about it, but I remember thinking, God, I can't be sleeping that much.
You know what I mean? And that's been honestly the story of my life for like the last 10 years. I always have too much going on. And like, even still now, it's still to some extent the case, but that's what I'm trying to work on. And I think like for me, that's probably a bigger gain in ROI than studying poker. You know, I can get better at 3-bet pots. I can get better at how I play the river at 30 big blinds or whatever, but, and that's going to help me and improve my win rate. But just having a consistent routine, I think, is a bigger win rate upgrade than learning how to play 3-bet pots.
Yeah. The thing you mentioned about writing down your goals for the session, I do the same thing, and I'm trying to remember where I got it from. I think I got it from Mark Galeotto, but I just get a little sticky pad and I stick it on the side of my monitor, and it'll be, like you said, I'm going to 3-bet more preflop. I'm going to target late position openers, you know, mm-hmm. to 3-bet like that. And then I stick that on the side of my monitor, and I kind of visually run through in my mind what that would look like. And then I start my session. And I don't look over a couple of hands before I play, though. Maybe I should start implementing that.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good extra piece you can add in. And it only takes 10 minutes. So it just kind of primes you and gets you ready. So when you get in your first hand, you're not just going in cold.
Yeah, yeah. You're not warming up in the first 10 minutes of your session. You've already done that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. I like that. What about habit forming and breaking bad habits? I could definitely use this one when it comes to nicotine. I'm chewing nicotine gum right now, and it's just not a healthy habit. When I go on vacation with my buddy, I ditch the gum and we smoke cigars. And then when I come back, I come back to the gum, and it's I could definitely use that in my life.
Well, that's exactly the example I was going to use. So you beat me to it, bringing that up. I've heard you on the podcast before talk about nicotine gum. And I think you've been chewing it for a long time, right?
Yeah. It's been years. It's this gum that's designed to help you quit. And I just keep buying more.
Yeah, I'm in the same exact boat. I'm chewing nicotine gum right now as well. I've been doing it for like 7 years. And yeah. That's like, I feel like that would be the biggest improvement for me right now that I could make, not just for poker, but just for like everything. I've tried to quit a bunch of times, and I've even gone like 2 weeks without any and then jumped back into it. And it's kind of like, you know, there's not as much of a stigma with nicotine gum. Like if we were cigarette smokers, there'd be that little extra motivation of, you know, it's kind of taboo and it's kind of sucks to have to like step outside and have a cigarette every hour or whatever.
Yeah, you always stink and you smell like smoke, and yeah.
So as nicotine gum chewers, it's not really that unhealthy. You know, you don't have all those extra chemicals in it and all that stuff. For me, the reasons I want to quit are the cost of it and the just like having the dependency. Like if I haven't had a piece for a while, my mood's going to be a little bit short tempered or whatever if I'm craving it. And so for me, I want to not have that in my life. I think that would be like, even for you too, because I know you've talked about wanting to stop. I think that the going through that process of actually quitting would be such a huge upgrade, because the amount of like sort of willpower and discipline you have to actually do that and make it stick is pretty tremendous. And doing that, I think, would feel like a pretty big accomplishment, and it would give both of us, if we did it, more confidence, and just, you know, it would feel really good. But it is really fucking hard.
Yeah, it is no joke. It is a powerful drug. I've heard that it's more difficult to quit than heroin, which I'll never try heroin, but I was listening to a audio book yesterday on financials, and this guy gave an example of a couple that, you know, instead of putting that money into a retirement account so they could retire sooner, they decided to literally light it up and put it into smoke. And so he did the math on, they smoked for 47 years. It eventually killed them. And he did the math on, had they invested that into Philip Morris, the tobacco company, they would have had over $1 million just from spending, you know, the dollar a day or whatever it was on cigarettes. I'm like, maybe that's a motivating factor. I looked over my statements and how much I spend on this fucking gum. It equates to about $1.25 a day. And I'm like, Yeah, I'm probably in the same boat. You know, if I could put that $45 a month or whatever it is into some growth stock mutual funds, I think I would be a lot better off than just chewing it.
Yeah, I've run those numbers too myself. And that's the reason, the biggest motivator for me is to take that money I'm spending on nicotine gum and invest it.
Yeah.
that's what I will, if I'm able to quit, that's what I want to do. But I've tried so many times and failed. I'm just going to keep trying, but it is tough.
Yeah, it's tough. It is no joke. And so for all the kiddos out there listening that want to get your vape pen and stuff, just don't do it. It's so not worth it. So not worth it. I wrote down poker as a side hustle. What were your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So that's what poker is to me these days. It's a side hustle. It's, you know, I put a lot of time into it and I make money from it. But I also have a full-time job and it's not my main source of income. And I just want to call out poker as being like a really awesome option to make extra money on the side. It's just, you know, I've been listening to a lot of these like personal finance podcasts and things like that. And they have people on and talk about, you know, they're really aggressive about trying to save money for retiring early. And a lot of what they talk about is side hustling. And I just think that poker is a really amazing option for that. And I also think that for people who are, you know, have a good job and have a decent income, that's an edge you can have over people who don't. If you're playing poker and you're serious about it and you're putting in work to study and get better, and you also don't rely on it as an income source, I think that's an edge over some people, where you don't have to worry about if you're going to make enough this month from poker to sustain yourself. All you're worried about is, you know, making this little extra income to invest or buy something you want or do whatever you want with the money. I think it's a little bit of a double-edged sword, especially if you're playing tournaments, like I said, because it's really hard to balance that with 40 hours a week of work or more if you're, you know, doing a salary job where you might work more than that. But it's a great opportunity right now. And there's a lot of, I think, whatever the opposite of optimism is.
Pessimism?
Yes, thank you. I need more coffee. there's a lot of that with poker these days, especially with online poker, and especially if you're in the US. But in my opinion, it's still a great environment. There's still plenty of money to be made, whether you're playing online or live, even if you're in the US. And I think probably most people who are listening to this are already poker players, but you know, maybe you, the way that you view the game right now is just like a fun hobby or something. There's not that much to be done to go from that point to turning it into a profitable side hustle. So I don't have any like groundbreaking stuff to talk about with that. I just wanted to kind of bring it up because I think it's a pretty awesome option for people.
I love it, man. I love, my mindset has changed a little bit from, I always got goals up on my mirror and stuff, you know, and one of them now is, first is listed, I'm a professional gambler. And then second is listed, I'm a professional poker player. And, I've noticed that my, I make about 15% of my annual income from gambling. And, this year it's more so coming from stocks and from, sports, from, football, than it is from, cards, but it's still an amazing game. I love the fact that I can calculate that, you know, I'm going to win this spot 54% of the time. It's a bet and that's it, you know, and not necessarily caring whether it hits or not, just knowing that I made the right decision and putting my money on the better side of variance. And to be able to make money from that is all you're doing. You're playing a game and you can make money from it. I mean, like, I think that's the best job in the world. You know what I mean? It's so much fun. I love it.
Yeah. And the other thing, you brought up a good point there of, you know, the skills that you'll build becoming good enough at poker to make money, can translate over to other forms of, gambling or just, you know, other industries that you can use those skills to make money. Like, we haven't really touched on this, but I've actually been doing Amazon FBA also for a little while.
Oh, good for you.
And I find that it's very similar to playing tournaments. Like I go into a store, I'm doing retail arbitrage. So okay. I'll go into retail stores and I try to find products that are underpriced that I can buy and sell on Amazon and make profit. And it's kind of similar to tournaments in a way where your goal is to put in volume and, you know, have a good enough, you know, you want to analyze your ROI and there's some variance. You're going to have, I've learned this, that there's more variance than I thought because of certain factors I didn't really know about, but you analyze a product, you say, okay, if I pay this $5 or $10 or whatever it is, on average, I'm going to make $3 profit from paying this $10 for this product. And sometimes the product doesn't sell. Sometimes a customer returns it and then you can't sell it and you have to just have it disposed of by Amazon or whatever. You're going to have some stuff that doesn't work out. But when you're putting in enough volume and you're making good decisions with your buys, you're going to make money over the long term. Yep. And if I hadn't ever played poker before and I just started trying to do FBA, I think I probably would have figured it out and made it work still. But coming from playing tournaments, it just all feels natural. It's like, okay, yeah, like this, sometimes this product's not going to sell. Sometimes I'm going to lose money on a product. But when I put in volume and I make good decisions, it's going to work out.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fun selling, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It's, I kind of enjoy the process of sourcing items. I think that's like my favorite part of it. That's where you actually have to use your brain and decide your strategy of, like, not only do I want to buy this product, but if there's 30 of them, how many should I buy?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's fun. It's, I've gotten a little burnt out on it and I'm thinking about, just kind of letting it die out to have more time to focus on poker. But yeah, I mean, it was a cool experience and I'm still doing it right now. But the thing that I hate about it is with what I'm doing, I go in and buy a bunch of stuff and then I have to bring it home and clean it up and remove the labels from it from the store.
Yep.
And put my own Amazon labels on it. And that piece of the process takes way too long and it's super boring.
Yes.
and you know, I was having some pretty decent months with it, but you know, I've also, poker's been bringing in more income than that is, and so I kind of just want to like go all in on poker right now because it's going well enough that it doesn't make sense to split my time between FBA and poker.
I've had a few guys message me and they're like, hey, I want to thank you for talking about Amazon on the show. I started selling on Amazon. Now I make a third of my annual income from it. I'm like, wow, that is pretty cool. At the, what you say you're going into department stores and stuff? Like, what kind of stuff are you looking for? What is it that you're keeping an eye out for and buying?
Yeah. So when I first started, I was going to like pretty much every store I could find and just scanning everything.
Yeah.
And buying whatever I could. Eventually I kind of identified just like two or three stores that were giving me the most profit. And then I just cut out all the other ones. For those stores, since those are the only ones I go to now, I'm really familiar with the layouts and like kind of their restocking cycle and that kind of stuff. So I basically just go for profit regardless of what type of product it is. So sporting goods, toys, even like tools, that kind of stuff. Pretty much whatever I can find. Like I don't lock myself to a few categories of products. I just kind of look through the whole store and look for good deals.
Okay. Now, are you selling everything new or are you doing some stuff used or?
Everything new. I did sell a bunch of books early on and a lot of those were used. But other than books, I wouldn't sell anything else used.
Yeah, I did the same kind of thing. The books were kind of neat. I ended up getting a pallet of them. Had hundreds of them and sent them in. And it was the kind of thing I was selling maybe two a day at a profit of a couple bucks a book, you know? But it was like, wow, for the next 6 months, I have, you know, $4 a day income coming in that I did not have before, you know?
it's cool. Yeah.
When you can get just a whole bunch of one item that you know is going to sell, because it's got a good ranking on Amazon. Oh man, I remember these ice trays I got. I got a giant box of them, and they were these little Star Wars ice trays for little kids, you know, so that they could have a Darth Vader as a, you know, figurine as a block of ice. Mm-hmm. And I was like, these have got to sell. Like, I don't, you know, so I scanned them, found them on Amazon. I'm like, oh my God, they sell for $8 for three of these ice trays, you know, and I got the whole box for like $4. This is amazing.
Score. Yeah.
Yes.
I kind of got lucky when I was starting out, because I found a local store that had some like liquidation book lot where like some bookstore went out of business down south. So these guys bought up all their inventory. So I was able to go in and buy a bunch of books, and I only got one, you know, I wasn't able to get like 20 of the same book or anything like that, but most of the books sold at either a very small profit or break even ish. But then okay. I had enough like huge outliers that I made a lot of money off it. Like I had a couple books. I had one I bought for like $10 or something, and it sold for like $180.
Wow.
Like within a couple of days. I had a few of those. So I might have bought 30 or 40 books, and like I sold three that paid for the whole cost of buying all those.
Nice.
And then the other ones, like, you know, I might have made a few bucks off each one or whatever. But yeah, that's, to me, that's kind of been a trend I've seen, where when I go out, if I buy, just to make up a number, if I buy $1,000 worth of stuff, I'll have a couple of like home runs in there that end up paying for the whole trip. And yeah, then the other ones are very small profit margins or even break even, or some might even lose me a little bit of money. But my whole approach is I just want to move stuff. So I'll lower my price to get rid of stuff, even if it's going to sell at a small loss, so that I can go out and keep repeating.
Yeah. It, there is a game too of, if it's on the shelf for too long, you're getting charged. Yeah. When I left, I think it was 64 cents a cubic foot per month for storage. Cause you basically box all this stuff up, put your own barcode on it, and then send it to Amazon. And now it sits in their warehouse until somebody presses click and buy. And then one of their robots comes along and pulls it off the shelf and sends it off, you know, so you're not keeping this stuff in your garage. You're shipping it off to them, and you got to pay a storage for it. So if you get something that, you know, it's like, wow, this may take 6 months to sell, but I'm going to make $100 on it, that's worth it. But if it's a book that's going to sit there for 6 months and you're only going to make 48 cents, probably ain't worth it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's stuff I'm kind of learning as I go. And I actually have a decent amount of stuff right now in Amazon that has been sitting for a while that I need to either have them just dispose of or send back to me or something.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a learning process. There's a lot going on with the marketplace.
Yeah. It's fun though. It's fun game.
Yeah, it is fun. Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Yeah. So what, swinging back to poker here, what, your, in your notes was a study process for MTTs. What are you doing for that? What software are you using? What are you using to study?
Yeah. So, I mostly brought this up because this is kind of a little piece I've added into my study routine that I think has been really helpful. And I kind of just wanted to share it so people could kind of pick it up and use it if they want to. And what it is a tagging system for hand histories. So I use Poker Tracker for my HUD and to store all my hand histories. And you have kind of default tags that are built into it that when you're playing, you can tag a hand for review. And there's a few other ones in there, so you can come back to it later. And you can filter all your hands by what tag they have. So what I've done is I've gone in and added to the default tags, and I've put in like 20 more of my own. So I have tags for basically every type of situation. So push fold spot, reshove spot, you know, single raise pot out of position, 3-bet pot in position as the caller, 3-bet pot out of position as the aggressor, all that kind of stuff. Limped pot. I just made tags for every like type of situation you can get into. And then I have a review tag, and I have a key lessons tag. So when I'm playing and I play a hand that I want to review, I always just tag that with the review tag. And then when I sit down to go through and review my hands, As I review each one, I remove that review tag and I put on the tag of the type of situation it was. And then I put in some notes as I do my review. You can save notes on the hand history in Poker Tracker and Hold Manager. And then what that does is just using the review tag for all hands, initially it makes it really easy to just filter the ones you want to look over. And then after you review them and put them into these buckets using these other tags, well, you're building a library of hand histories that you can go back and study. So, you know, if I decide, I kind of have two pieces to what I study each week. So one is reviewing hands that I played recently, and the other is like a specific topic that I'm working on. So like this week, it's three bet pots. So I'm reviewing marked hands that I played that could be any kind of situation, but then I'm also going back and looking at three bet pot hands. And because I'm tagging these hands as I review them, I have this big library of hands I've played with notes on them that I've reviewed before.
Okay.
So that's useful for kind of cycling through different situations. And also that's useful for your pre-session. If you want to do a quick warm-up, you can just pull up a tag and just look through hands that you've already reviewed that have notes on them.
That's brilliant. I flag them in Holder Manager too. It's got a little flag there that, you know, you just click it for review, but I never even thought of or knew that you could do that and create subheadings and then filter them like that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And I use the key lessons one for hands that I'm reviewing where I kind of learned something that I never knew before, or learned something where I'm like consistently making a mistake in a certain situation. Like there might be a spot where I might not be rejamming wide enough. Like if, you know, let's just say cutoff opens, let's say we have 20 big blinds effective, cutoff opens, button flats, and I'm in the blinds. Yeah. And I'm reviewing that spot where I folded a hand and it turns out that that's a hand I should have reshoved, and I also should have reshoved like five hands that are worse than that or something, where yeah. I'm just being way too tight. That if it's something like that where I'm making a big mistake where I'm consistently making it, I will do a deeper review of the hand and put more notes than I normally would, and I'll tag that with key lessons. And then that way you can also kind of go back once a month or something and just go through all those to kind of see like, oh, wow, like I learned all this stuff the last few months that I didn't know before.
Yeah. Yeah. I like it. I like it. Cool. Cool. Yeah. Well, you mentioned that you have a couple of hands.
Yeah, I do. I've got a couple here. So these hands are both hands that I don't have like the hand history like in Poker Tracker in front of me. They're just written down.
Okay. All right. Well, let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and do some strategy. Take a second here and thank our sponsors. Boy, you couldn't have slapped the smile off my face when Doug talked about Elliot without me even bringing him up. Elliot Rowe, get your meditation tape for just before you play for whatever game you're going to play, whether it's online, live, cash, tournaments, whatever your game, Elliot Rowe has it. Try his 7-minute tilt buster for free. Click on the link in the show notes. It'll take you straight there and then use the code HUPOKER to score yourself a little discount. Alexander Fitzgerald's Master Tournament Poker in One Class. Become better than 95% of your competition in all tournaments, $2,000 and below, from this one class. Use the code HUPOKER and you will score yourself 75% off of Alexander Fitzgerald's class. It's the best class I've ever taken on poker, hands down. That's why I offer it to you. Without further ado, let's get back to Doug and talk some strat. Okay, we're back. What do you got, Doug? You said that these aren't from your HUD. You wrote them down. Were they live or were they online? Or
yeah, these were online. The reason that I just have them written down is because one is actually one that I wrote down in a notepad last night. I was playing a session and I just didn't get a chance to mark the hand because the table closed out. So I just kind of wrote it down. And the other one is from about a month and a half ago or so. And I just, it's in my database somewhere, but I had it in Skype that I had sent the hand history to someone. So I just kind of copy pasted it.
Okay.
So I guess I'll start with the one from last night. And this one is, a kind of simple situation, but, it's one that I'm gonna go and analyze probably after this call, cause it's, a hand that's been bugging me from last night, but it's a hand where I made a very loose shove. And I think it's a kind of interesting spot. So I'll set it up. This was in a pretty small tournament on ACR. It's like an $11 tournament.
Okay.
And we are almost in the money. There's like 89 players left or something like that, 88. And they're and it was like around 80 places cashed, something like that.
Okay.
So we're close to the bubble, but a little ways off from it. And in this hand, I'm in the small blind with 5-3 suited. And it folds around to the button. And the button has about 20 big blinds. I have about 14 or so, 14 point something, a little under 15. So, and then big blind also has about 20. Now, first of all, if it had just folded to me and I have 14 DBs and I would just shove 5-3 suited here, I think it's gonna be, you're gonna get enough folds versus population on most of these sites that it's gonna be profitable. And it's just too weak of a hand to like raise fold or like, or sorry, to limp. I would want it to be a little bit stronger of a hand to limp.
I agree. Yeah, so, I would shove that. Maybe even 15 big blinds. I think 16 big blinds, I might not, but.
Yeah, I think that's about the cutoff, about 15. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I agree. And the big blind also is, I didn't have a huge sample of hands on them, but they're looking like their stats are looking like kind of reasonable. Like they're a bit of a reg, but a little bit tight. So it was something like maybe like 18, 13 or something like that.
Okay.
So they're, you know, they're reasonable, but a little bit on the tight side, I guess, which is another, you know, that gives us more reason to shove too.
Oh, yeah.
So anyways, in the hand, the button limps and he's got about 20 bigs and he's just seems like a really big fish. Again, not a big sample on them, but their default play from every position was to just limp a ton. Like they're limping like 45% or something.
Oh, that's amazing.
So right away.
Music to my ears.
Yeah. So his range already is like, you know, just super weak. So I just went ahead and just jammed, since if it had folded to me, I would have jammed. And this guy's limping way too much. And he's probably just limp folding like way too much. So I just jammed. And I think that it's the correct play. But I wrote it down because I wasn't sure with the limper. In general, when someone limps in front of me, like let's say I'm in position like where I'm in cutoff or something and like middle position limps, my general approach at most stack sizes is I'm gonna ISO the limper with a range that's just slightly tighter than the range I would have just opened with if it had folded to me. So if I'm gonna open 20% in a spot and someone limps in front of me, I'll probably just ISO like 18% or something. Like I'll just tighten it up just a little bit. But with this guy being just very clearly like limping way too much, I just thought the shove was going to be pretty profitable. And instead of over limping, I just went for the shove.
Yeah. Do you have any numbers on the button? Do you remember?
Yeah. So the button was the guy that limped and he was like 43 to 45% limp. And then like, I don't remember exactly what his VFIP PFR was, but he had a very low PFR.
Okay. Like 10 or something.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's almost like he's, and again, it wasn't a big sample. I think I might've had 50 hands or 80 hands or something on him, but even over that sample, I think to me what that indicates is that he's not just like, he's not putting really much thought into constructing a limping range. He's just limping unless he thinks his hand is strong and then he's raising. He's like raising all his good hands and then just limping a bunch of shit.
Yeah. I like it. The thing sometimes with these guys is, you know, when they got a limping range of 45%, sometimes they're just calling stations and they're like, well, I have queen nine suited here, I'll snap him off. But I think being close to the bubble and the way you described him and everything, I think I would shove there too.
Cool. Yeah. And what you said about them being calling stations, I think that's 100% true, but I think it's more of a factor when we're deeper. Like if we had 40 big blinds and I wasn't jamming, like if I was just considering like making it 4X or something, they call a bunch. And then that's going to be like a tough spot for us. But where I'm just shoving preflop, I don't think he can really be too much of a calling station. If it's, you know, he has 20 bigs, I have almost 15. So he's going to be left with five if he does call this shove. So yeah, I think that's going to be helpful for us where he can't really just limp call too much.
Yeah.
But yeah, yeah, cool.
Yeah, I like it. Did he wake up with sevens or something? Or
No, the big blind just snapshot because he had ace king and then the limper folded.
Oh, okay.
So we got lucky and we ran into ace king, but I think this is a pretty profitable shove.
I think so. I think the big blind is folding there a lot, probably over folding.
Yeah.
Well, I guess anything is over folding to a five high, but I think you know what I mean.
Yeah. He's going to fold often enough. I think that, yeah.
Yeah. That's a profitable one. It's always a stinger though, when you go out right before the money.
Yeah. And you know, that's another adjustment I've made to my game where I respect the bubble a lot these days. Like I am very tight around the bubble. And I think that's the correct approach. And you can somewhat simulate that with like holding resources or ICMizer. And you'll see if you do that, that you, if you put in this spot and you try to like put in like approximate stacks and put in that there's like eight other tables left and you're five away from the bubble, it will actually be quite a bit tighter in its ranges that it spits out. I used to be just like, you know, fuck that. I'm trying to build a stack. I'm going to just go for it on the bubble here. But I actually think that mathematically, if you're just trying to make the highest EV decisions, it makes a lot of sense to respect the bubble a bit more and be tight in certain situations.
I think so too. After going through Alex's course, Master Tournament Poker, in one class, one of the things he says in there, and it's true when you logically think about it, he said the biggest pay jump in the tournament is from the bubble boy to the min cash, and he says the second one is from second to first. You know, you get zero money if you go out on the bubble, and then you get your money back and then some, and then from second to first. Actually, I think second to first is the first, and then the second one is the bubble boy. But it's true. For years, I don't even know where I got it. I probably just read it in one of those books that came out when poker was super popular and everyone was putting out a book every week just to cash in. But they're like, don't do that. Just go for the win. You know, if you bubble, it's no big deal. But all those min caches add up quite a bit, you know, as far as leveling out your graph.
Yeah, man, I can't tell you how much money I've made just this past year just from like being a nit near the bubble.
Yeah, right.
And I used to post hands on like forums and stuff, and that be, you know, being like five off of the min cash or whatever, and being like, yeah, I think we should just fold here. And almost every time I would get like, what are you crazy? Like, you got to just go for it. Like, you got to be, I'm not trying to min cash. You got to be trying to win the tournament. And it's like, well, kind of, I guess, but like, no, your goal should really be is to maximize your EV in every decision you make. And if that means being a nit, because you can like 90% of the time, if you fold here, you're going to min cash, then you got to just do that.
Yeah.
I do have one more hand that's from a little while back.
Okay.
Score I had recently. So this hand is, we're heads up, and it's at the final table of a 162. The player in hand was like pretty competent at the time, if I remember. This was on Bovada, so I didn't really have like good stats on them or anything, but they seemed like they were just like solid, but not like, I don't know. I wasn't like intimidated by them based on how they played throughout the final table. I guess like they were solid, but they weren't like, I didn't feel like they were going to be like super outclassing me or whatever.
Okay.
So to set up this hand, this hand happened when we had been playing heads up maybe for like four or five hands. So not very long, into heads up.
Okay.
And the play preflop here is based pretty heavily on game flow too. So I'll just start going through the hand history and then I'll kind of add more context, but I'm in the big blind here and, villain is small blind slash button. He has 58 big blinds. I have 36. And so he min raises which he'd been doing like with every time he opened the button, I believe he was just min raising. And then I have 8-4 off and I decided to 3-bet. And part of the reason that I did that is because I hadn't 3-bet once yet during the heads up. And I also hadn't really 3-bet much prior to heads up. So first time I've 3-bet in a long time, perhaps since it was like 6-handed or so at the final table.
Okay.
And I also think that heads up, you should be pretty polarized with your 3-bets here. Although I do think that in general, this is probably a bit too light and we probably can pick some better hands. But because I hadn't 3-bet yet and I just felt like game flow wise, it just made sense to me at the time.
There's moments like that that come up in heads up matches. And when I look over my hand histories, I'm like, if you look at the hand in a vacuum, you would be like, WTF, what were you thinking? Yeah. But when you look at the whole heads up match as a whole, there's just some timing ones, you know? It's just like, I haven't 3-bet when I've been in this spot, and this is the third time he's done it. I just have to 3-bet him here no matter what I've got, and that's just the flow of it, you know?
And I mean, if you look at, like, a lot of, like, the top players do talk about this kind of stuff in live tournaments or whatever, and even, like, the old school, like, heads-up crushers used to be a big thing that was talked about. I think nowadays, if you're talking about, like, high-stakes heads-up cash or whatever, that's not a thing. Like, they're just playing as close to GTO as they can. But when you're playing a tournament on Bovada, yeah, I think it is a thing and it's worth trying to pay attention to.
Yeah. Yeah. Right on. Okay. So he min raised to 2 big blinds. And then what do you 3-bet to?
I 3-bet to 6.6 big blinds.
Okay.
Which I have no idea if that's a good sizing. I am by no means a heads up expert. It's just the sizing I went with.
I like it more than 3x because you're going to be out of position for the rest of the hand and you'd really like them to fold. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, those were kind of my thoughts too at the time. So he calls the 3-bet. So pot is 13.5 big blinds and effective stacks on the flop are, let's see, about 29.
Okay.
Yeah, about 29 effective and 13.5 in the pot. And the flop is 6-4-4. So bingo, we flop trips.
No, that's what you got to do, man. You remember to hit your trips.
Yeah. If you're going to 8-4 off, you should do it when 2-4s are coming on the flop.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And you had the foresight to see that. So that's, was good.
Yeah. So, so I'm first to act, I'm the aggressor. So I bet really small. I bet 3.5 big blinds into the 13.5 big blind pot.
I like it. I was going to say somewhere between 2.5 and 3 and you know, you just have him crushed here. And so,
yeah. You just want him to call with like with this sizing, I want him to call all of his overcard combos. Like if he has like ace queen or king queen or something like that, just 2 overs, I want him to be calling with all that. He should be floating extremely wide with most of his range when I make this bet.
Yeah. I mean, I think if he folds ace high here, if he folds queen jack, that's just a disaster for us. We want him to be calling all that, and we got to make it small for him to do it.
Yep.
Okay.
I agree. So he calls, and now on the turn.
Okay, let's see. So we got another 7 bigs in there. So we've got 20.5 big blinds in the pot going to the turn. Is that what I'm getting?
Yep, 20.5, and I have about 25.5 big blinds left in my stack.
Okay.
Turn is the 10 of clubs, so now it's 6-4-4-10 with 2 clubs. Okay. And on the turn, I decided to check, and he bets 6 BB into 20.5.
Okay, what your hand is 8-4 offsuit, so we got the trips here. What is one of them a club?
No, I do not have a club. Oh yes, sorry, I do. The 4 is a club. So it I do have 1 club.
Okay.
Yep.
8-4, so you got 1 club. So you have a slight blocker to any flush draws he's got. Okay.
Yeah, so if he does have any flush draws here on the turn, my club helps a little bit because he has less chance of rivering the flush.
Yeah. What was your thought process for checking here?
So this hand was a little while ago, but I believe that the reason I checked here is because, again, going back to the flop, I felt that he's going to float this flop bet with like most of his range, maybe even all of his range. However, if I'm double barreling here after three betting, I probably just end up folding out a lot of his range if he has anything like king, queen, ace, queen, king, jack, anything like that, where he just has like air, he just has like king high or ace high. He's going to probably just bet to the second, he's probably just going to fold to the second barrel here, those hands.
Okay.
And I do not want him folding.
Yeah. Okay.
If he has a 10, if he had turned top pair, then it doesn't really matter, because whether if I bet, he's probably going to call. If I check, he's most certainly going to bet. But even if he does have a 10, and I barrel the turn, something like if he gets to the flop with like 10 jack suited or queen jack or queen 10 or ace 10 or something like that, like his hand's still not that great in a three bet pot. So I don't want to like triple barrel here and have him hero fold river with some of those hands.
Okay.
So I just felt that checking turn is going to just get the maximum value from most of his range here, because with his value hands, he's probably going to bet on the turn. And if I checked him, and then if he has a hand like just ace high, king high with those Broadway combos, he's probably going to be able to find a fold. But by checking, I do give him a chance to kind of like semi-bluff with some of those hands, either on the turn or the river.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, as far as turn cards, I think I'd like to see an ace the most, and then second would probably be a 10. I feel like people play a lot of 10s with the straight draws and stuff in there, and the aces, of course.
Yep. But,
I guess maybe you're right. Maybe this is like a two-street value hand and not a three-street value one.
Well, my hand, I think, is just – I'm just going broke with my hand if I can.
Oh yeah, of course. But I guess I'm saying is that considering his range in the board, you're probably going to get a bet on the flop and a bet on the turn, but not the river, or flop, not the turn, but then the river, you know, and you can probably get more on the river than you could hoping he catches up.
Yep. I agree.
Okay. All right. So we check.
So we check, again, pots 20 and a half big blinds. He bet 6 big blinds into it. I call. So now the pot's 32 and a half, and I have about 19 left. So I have like well under pot left in my stack here on the river.
Okay. And I'm sorry, we have 19 and the pot is 32. Okay. So we got, good. We got a little less than 2/3 of the pot. With your call, you probably don't remember because it was a month and a half ago, but in spots like this, you can't really give away a tell other than timing when we're playing online. Mm-hmm. But on ones like this, I kind of tend to maybe take a second.
Yeah, and then, I generally try to take about 5 seconds with any spot if I'm really focused on my session. Yeah. I generally, if I can, I try to just balance it by taking about 5 seconds.
Yeah. Okay.
Time, which I think I did here. Yeah.
Okay.
So we call 32 and a half bigs. We have 19 or 19 and a half, and the board now is 7 of clubs on the river. So it's 6 of clubs, 4-4, 10 of clubs, 7 of clubs.
Okay.
And we do have a 4 of clubs in our hand, which doesn't really matter that much at this point. I don't think we really block anything with that, because I don't think he really calls preflop with too many 4-club combos, so I don't think it's really relevant.
Well, he can't have pocket fours, because three of them are accounted for, and I think the only other one would probably be ace 4 of clubs suited. I can't imagine him doing that with 5-4 suited. I think that would be a mistake to call a 3-bet preflop. So, yeah, I guess we essentially block one hand.
Yeah, that's fair. I guess is worth bringing up. But yeah, we blocked the ace 4 of clubs. So he bet the river, bet the turn after I checked to him. And then we get to this river, 7 of clubs. I check again. and he shoves. And I call. I'm not, you know, if he did get the flush here, okay. Like, he's going to be able to have some flushes here, but he's also going to be able to have a bunch of other stuff, I think.
Yeah. Now, your reasoning for checking the river.
Because I want to allow him, like, if he has a strong 10, ace 10, king 10, something like that, I think the money is getting in either way. But I also felt that it's possible he could still just have some bluffs here. Like,
yeah,
because of the action, like, I see bet flop and then I check call turn. And now if he's sitting here on the river and he decided to bet river with something like ace king or king queen or something like that, his only chance of winning is bluffing.
Yeah.
He can't really beat any hands in my range right now if he has like ace high or something. So with all of his value hands, I think the money is going in either way. And then if he still has any sort of bluffs, like, my only chance for getting it is by checking.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So I checked and he shoved and I call, and I think he ended up having ace 10 here.
Oh, perfect.
So yeah. So with that exact combo, it probably doesn't matter too much. Like, probably the money gets in anyway, but
yeah, I'm sure, like, if you shove that river, he's calling.
Yeah, but I don't know, like, on the turn, if I try to go bet, like, if I don't check the turn here, I think he gets away from it, because this is a 3-bet pot, you know, it's like a $3,000 pay jump or something like that. I think he can get away from top pair with a 10 in a 3-bet pot if I do go bet. I think it's certainly possible he could hero fold. So I think that by checking the turn, I think that was pretty helpful for me to get this amount of chips out of him.
Yeah, to double up.
Yeah.
I don't know. What, how'd the tournament turn out? Did you win or did you get second?
I did. I won it. And I think this was like a key hand. Like, this was a turning point for this turn, for this heads up, because, like I said, going into this hand, it was 35 big blinds to 58. I was behind. And then after this hand, I had 70 and he had 20 or something like that. 22.
Yeah.
Or something.
Yeah. Now he's in push fold mode at your deciding whether you can beat that range.
Yeah.
Right on. Good for you, man. What was that score?
That was 9K-ish. 9-something.
Well done, sir.
Yeah, thanks. And it's funny. This is a perfect example of a night I shouldn't really have played, because I had to work the next day, and this tournament got over at like 5:30 a.m.
Oh, God.
So, you know, I can't always perfect. Sometimes I just really want to play and I just play. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's tough. It's tough, balancing it. You know, I'm motivated to make money and I like playing tournaments and it does make me money. So sometimes I play when I probably am going to be really tired the next day, but, you know, it's a constant battle to balance that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, as poker players, none of us are perfect. Right on. Cool. Well, you have a free gift for our listeners. You want to fill them in on that?
Yeah. So, I have set up a little form that people can go fill out if they're interested in getting free, tournament coaching from me. So the URL, let me just really quick, I'm just going to type it in just to make sure I say the right one.
Okay. we can put a link in the show notes as well. So when you click on the link in the show notes, it'll be right there.
Yeah. It's bit.ly/free poker coaching. So it's just bit.ly/free poker coaching. And it's just a really simple form, a couple of questions about poker, about just what it means to you and how long you've been playing and things like that. And I'm just going to do a free session of, you know, an hour to an hour and a half for anyone who's interested, who fills this out. If I get like a bunch of people, I might not have time to do it with everyone. But just, it's a free roll. So if you're interested, go ahead and fill that out. And I'd love to get to know people and do some looking over hands.
Yeah. And I've studied quite a bit with Doug over the years, and he is very, very intelligent and very savvy when it comes to all the software and programs and let's plug it into this and see what the answer is, you know, so it, definitely very cool. And thank you for doing that, Doug. This will make you better at cards as well.
Yeah, exactly. And that's really what part of why I'm doing it. It's not just like, in a way, it's a little bit selfish because really I'm just trying to get people to come hang out and study with me.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure you'll get a couple of students out of it too.
Cool, yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, right on. Cool. Was there anything else you wanted to say, or should we wrap this up and put a bow on it?
I guess really quick, I'll plug my, I have like this little blog on Run It Once on their forums.
Cool.
If anyone's like just curious about reading more about my path and where I come from and what I've been doing, if you just go to the journal section on runitonce.com, it's called Poker and Code, Code and Poker. That's my blog.
Right on. Good deal. Well, thank you, Doug.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
All righty. And thank you for tuning in. Here is your weekly motivational speech.
Stress, fear, and discomfort all promote growth. The more often you willingly place yourself in the uncomfortable, the more you'll find moments of progress, moments of growth. You'll get better, stronger, and more confident. When this becomes a habit, the tough situations in the future, when faced with something bigger, the courage and strength you've built, the stronger person you've become, now prepares you to get through and come out the other side. Your growth is in the gap, from where you are now to where you want to be. It's what's inside this gap, the walls, barriers, fears, and the uncomfortable that you need to go through. This is what's going to grow you into the person you were born to be. At times when others would normally crumble, you'll rise up. At times when others steer away, you'll straighten the wheel. You'll have complete conviction you can take on what's in front of you. Understand, this is the way for massive personal growth, realizing your ultimate dreams and becoming the strongest, best version of yourself. It's having trust and faith, knowing everything is awaiting you on the other side, knowing you've willingly placed yourself in these moments. Ask yourself, when was the last time I stepped into the uncomfortable?